Jim Brown, Reel 3.
Good. Found out a film star in an old-fashioned movie.
That's right. What was he singing?
Seems there's no end to my rainbow, why don't my dreams come true? It's an old-fashioned song. And I thought to myself, the hammering we'd taken, and this cold morning, there's all of them trying to sing this old-fashioned song of hope of the music halls. What a dirge. But
now, where were you now?
Cordova, La Pira, near La Pira, down south. And they moved on, wandered on, they're breaking through. But after a few more episodes, we lost quite a lot of men. John Cornford died there. Ralph Fox died there. Some good men died there. But we were then told, we're going up, jumping lorries, we went to Madrid. We went to, there was a big attack developed. We had to take a place called Les Rosas, sort of just outside Madrid, and went there. We were better, more troops this time. Same rifle, sir. And we attacked, it was cold. And I always remember, these are only incidents, but this is all I know, and this is the real life of it. We were marching in columns of three columns of 30 men in a column. Nathan was on our right. And we passed a gate, and we were being machine gunned, and it was fascinating. As each man passed by the gate, the bullet missed him and went into the ground. And it was, the bullet dodged man after man. It looked as if, or it seemed, I don't know, as if the belt of the machine gun firing, it coincided with the switch to the next bullet, however far, with a man passing. And years afterwards I met a chap, he said to me, do you remember that machine gun firing? The bloke behind it must have wondered what was happening, he couldn't hit anyone. But we all passed through it, and it was amazing really to see the bullets hitting the ground, side you're sending nuts about to burst, and each one being missing. But went on a bit more, then they shelled us, and shelled got very near, very near. Nathan was a bit perturbed anyway, said, flatten behind the crest, which we did. We stayed behind this crest, and they started to shell us on the crest. And the shelling was bad, of course, you could hear them coming right on you. Some chap left of me, come from Manchester, he had some biscuits, how long he'd travelled with my don't know. He said to me, have a biscuit, of course. I said, thanks. Although you didn't feel like eating, your mouth was too dry. He says, I'm eating my biscuits. He said, let's eat them. He said, don't want the fascists to eat my biscuits. We're done. So, fair enough. And there was a white house to the right of us, and they were machine gunning there, and we dodged position. Of course, they had us at an angle. And they sent for a tank. I always remember it. The tank came up in the dip below at the back of us. It stopped to get instructions, and the driver got out, and he saw one of our blokes there dead on the ground. And he got out, and he stood there for almost half a minute saluting the dead man, which I thought was rather nice of him. He looked at the dead man and he saluted him, about half a minute. Then he got in and instructed, straight to the house, the tank went.
What kind of tank was it?
Well, it was a small tank. It wasn't big, I know that. It wasn't big. It was no giant tank. It was small. I doubt if it was bigger than an armoured car, but it wasn't big. It was a light tank. Light tank. It's nothing like the tanks you see today. Not so big, nowhere near it. But it's a light tank.
Do you know what kind of planes were attacking them?
Oh, yes. There was a Messerschmitts and Stukas, dive bombers. The Italians had Dornias. And when they dived, they really dived, and I think the effect of it was the thing you had to counteract, because they dived and their machine guns were belting. And the effect was a bit shattering, even when you got used to them, because the plane itself, as it comes down, is shaking. And however good the bloke is with a machine gun, if the plane is vibrating, it's not going to be accurate. So you had chances that way. And if you were in a slip trench, that was turned at an angle, you could slide this way as he came, or slide back this way. You had chances like that, and the amount of effort they put into it, the damage they did, wasn't all that. You could tell that by the people who survived these attacks.
Had you known before you went out there how heavily the Germans were involved?
No, but I knew it would be very severe. I knew that there were Germans and Italians. I knew it would be very, very tough, obviously. You must expect that. But how, you're right there, how heavy they were involved. Always you were conscious. Always conscious. They had the equipment. That was the one factor that always stood out. They had the equipment. That you could never overlook or even overcome. Always they had a preponderance of arms, and well and truly you knew it. But
you mentioned some of the equipment you had, those guns, for instance. Was there anything wrong with them besides the fact that they were old?
Yes. They were worn out. Sometimes they jammed. They jammed so often. And the early rifles were so small, they could explode. Caused a lot of damage to the user. Yes. They weren't of much value. But they were better than nothing. That's the point. They were still, you had something. And when we got to Las Rosas, I saw three French 75 field guns. They were ours. They had the old-fashioned wooden wheels with the bullnose arm, old-fashioned wooden wheels. And I looked at me, they're good guns. He said, 75s, used by the French in the First World War. I said, they are good. So I saw three of them, so we definitely were improving, no doubt about that. But
how was your ammunition supply?
Well, in Cordoba, not much. You got this kind of a bandolier with the three pouches, and I think we had about 200 rounds or so at the start. But these pouches, they were a failure, because when you threw yourself down on the ground, as you had to search for every dip and that, they tended to throw you up in the air. You see, they were wrong. You could gain another 4 inches by removing those. So to have a thing that pushes you up in the air was wrong. Whoever designed them was wrong. So I found they were a defect. All right, if they were at the side, but not in front of you where you laid down and you land on top of those. Obviously, it was wrong. But at Arama, the ammunition wasn't bad, although at one time it went very, very short, very, very dodgy. That was it, run out, actually. But it wasn't too bad at Arama, the rifle ammunition wasn't too bad. The rifles wasn't bad, although they, from my point of view, had defects. They did have defects. But
did you have bayonets?
Yes, oh yes, long blue steel bayonets, almost like a thin triangular point. And on that, the rifles were a bit loose. You had to fix the bayonet to lock the rifle to become rigid, and it was accurate. But if that bayonet wasn't fixed, the rifle tended to be a bit loose. But by fixing the bayonet in it, the rifle itself locked. Each part then was secure and became accurate. But the rifle with the bayonet in was long, the rifle was light, very long with the bayonet. And I thought, it might be handy if you meet horsemen or anybody like that, so light to handle, push up, and you've got such a length. But in a narrow trench, a rifle of that length, it tends to be an handicap. You've got to get it down somewhere. And it's rather too long for a narrow slip place, so you had that defect. But it was light, but it wasn't too bad. It was far better than the stairs. These were Russian rifles, I gather, from our friends in Mexico. But they weren't too bad. Also, if I can jump forward a bit, there appeared at Arama a strange contraption. It was a plate. It had a bit of a fitting like you see on a mousetrap on a spring, where the mousetrap spring jerked. But instead of the kind of goalposts you see on a mousetrap, three parts of an open, it had a spike. You put the mortar on it, and you pull the string of wire, and release the spring, and this spike whoop, hit the bar, and in theory the mortar would sail right over and cause quite a lot of damage to the enemy. But in practice, it always went the wrong way. So consequently, it was more dangerous to the user than the enemy, so we didn't use it. I thought it looked like a bit left over from the Trojan Wars. More humorous than dangerous. But of course, it's ridiculous even to have that sort of stuff. But that was bad, having that. I don't know what brain figured that out, but certainly it belonged to some other age, some other army.
So did you abandon those?
Oh, yes. Useless. Useless, or it might be all right for a comic act, but not for more. But
did you need the bayonets?
Well, it was always possible. It was used. It was used in the early stages, especially with the Moors. It was always possible, especially with the Moors, because the Moors, they had quite a name, and you've got to give, say to speak the truth, the Moors were brave. They knew more about fighting than we did, or I did. Far more. Far more. Theirs was an art. You could be lying with good cover. They couldn't hit you. But they pick a place to ricochet off the wall, whatever you were, onto you. See, they knew all the gags. And they could hide and camouflage. Of course, you learn all, or many things. At first, you tend to over-camouflage yourself, which draws attention. You tend to pull all sorts of olive leaves out of you, and learning you're showing them where you are. And when you see olive leaves at the base of a tree, you know they shouldn't be there. So these are obvious blunders, but, and you always keep off roads, obviously, you must do that. But this, armed, yes, we were always outclassed. The use of the bayonet, I took the view, myself, being a city dweller, not too conversant with the wars of nomadic people, that they knew more than me. So what I did, they probably knew how to handle a sword better than me. Obviously they did. So I always took the view, keep a couple of bullets in, then if it's a bayonet fight, I'll shoot a bullet at him and beat him. Then his swords are going to be no good to him then. This was my view, which I consider was the best attitude to adopt. But you saw the enemy several times, but mostly with them it was the heavy stuff, the artillery, the planes, and the cavalry, you saw that. But I'll say this, we left Las Rosas, we went back, we left the trench, we was in the 14th Brigade. We went to Madrigueras to join the 15th Brigade, British Battalion. Stopped at Albacete, have a bit of a speech from LaSalle. He said, First British Company was a credit to the whole of the International Brigade's discipline and courage at Lapeer, and so on, so on. Anyway, quite a good speech, I thought, especially when people praise him. We went back to Madrigueras, joined up with the British.
Now, your mentioning of LaSalle reminds me about the incident in which he was accused of spying.
Yes.
Could you tell me about that?
I can only tell you what I know.
That's what I mean.
Yes. I'll tell you what I know, because there's been, apparently there's a hell of an uproar in the French Senate, the French Parliament. There's a hell of an uproar. Much has been made by writers like you, Thomas. I don't wish to mention things that I don't know. I can only say what I know. Before we went to Lapeer, LaSalle could have been better in his attitude.
What do you mean?
Well, we were a bit separated from the French, And there could have been more stress on unity, different peoples. There could have been that. Also, on that, the sound, chap who I knew, who was Lapira, said to me, LaSalle, he said, I, Maurice Levine and Sid Quinn, two men, he said, we had to guard LaSalle last night. And when we woke up in the morning, everyone had vanished. He said, where did you go that night? I said, I don't know when we went that night 40 years ago. I said, asking a lot. He said, well, we had to guard LaSalle. He said, at Madrigal, he said, we had to go and see LaSalle, and he came to the door in pyjamas with a revolver in his hand, and we thought it rather strange a man act like that, not on the front, holding a revolver. But I also heard from a man, a very reliable man, honest man, Pete Jensen, the Dutchman, who was with us, said LaSalle's on trial. And each unit or that would have access. Anyway, we heard it's on trial. This was at Lapira. And it appeared that he went before the court. It's what I heard. 10 o'clock in the morning, court adjourned at 12. German chairman. And he was found guilty. The pie supposed to have been in the fascist lines at Lapira. And the boys knew that. He was sent to Monsieur, and apparently, whether it's true or not, I don't know, I heard, that before he was sentenced, he said, Viva la Revolution. And he was corrected and said, Viva la Anti-Fascist Revolution, which he corrected himself. It was also said at Lapira that he sent a note to the British company congratulating them and praising them for this stand at Lapira. This also was said. And LaSalle, as a spy, according to people like Jensen, he was a spy. He had gone into the fascist lines at night at Lapira. So, whether he was a spy, I know this. Things could have been better, and I know nothing, military strategy, tactics, warfare, anything like that, and knew nothing then. But I do know this. On hindsight, that when we attacked at Lapira, we were on our own. There was no French or Spaniards. We just went out on our own. Of course, we got hammered. But why weren't they there? I don't know. One night, we were walking round at Lapira, marching, bitterly cold, and we passed over the same road three times, and people began to get suspicious. Why? So there was certainly a lot of grounds for suspicion. And Walters, I think he had information on him. So from what I know and experience, LaSalle, from what I heard, from the position there at Lapira, LaSalle was reputed at the time to be an ex-Hungarian MP, a secret agent for the Soviet Union. You see, these towers being told, well, however much you, I don't know about these things, but I must mention, of course, this conveys the atmosphere at the time. But the boys were glad he was shot. That I'll say. And when we had a meeting with the French and we elected a new commander. There was a man called Ralph Campo, a London waiter, I think, who was the interpreter, and the French wanted, and the British wanted, George Nathan to be commander, and everyone was pleased that he was made commander, because far better type of man, more reliable, more trustworthy, more honest, braver. But he had what people wanted, a good leader he was. So therefore I think we gained immeasurably from Nathan taking over, and from LaSalle. But to go into details of exactly why and what, I wouldn't know. And I would be wrong to start saying things that I don't know about.
But you said LaSalle met you when you got back to Albacete?
No, Marty. Andrew Marty. Andrew Marty. Oh, sorry. But Andrew Marty.
And
the Frenchman.
He's the one then who praised you.
Oh, yes, Andrew Marty. There were at that time some Americans and various women who were in the Boring. This was in the Boring. And he gave a speech to those and to us. And that was Andrew Marty at that time. And we left there, we went to Madrigal, joined up with 15th Brigade. I went into hospital, I was ill, picked up a bag or something. Then I went to Harama. The fighting was on when I got there, and I thought it was very bad. It was bad. It was really bad. But I was in a group, unit, Bolger, London bookmaker from North London. Man spoke with a very cultured, quiet voice, very self-controlled man. An amazing man, because he's so quiet, so self-controlled, and so brave. He died as he had to die, because you cannot do what Bolger did. We were drawn, I think it was to Chinchon for a couple of days, Chinchon. Then back to the line. He only had 2 days to be deloused. And Bolger went back to the lines to go in no man's land to try and find the dead, to see if he could get any letters or papers to send back to the relations, because he got killed doing it. There's a man who took all those chances. Well, there's a little group, I was in this group, got to make 50 yards before nightfall. They did, but they didn't make 50 yards, run under the olive tree. One man take the first tree, second man take the second tree. They got caught by a machine gun burst. God damn it. So he said, there's a little traction I was in, you'll have to go. He says, it's got to be done. Take your time, he says. But the best thing is one man take the first tree, the second man take the second, which meant that the last man had got a long way to run. So obviously you had to act quick. They gave us an orange and a bit of gritty chocolate. I think that was some sort of compensation. Next of kin or rat lark they took. So it sounded all right. So away we went. I got about the third tree. I didn't want to leave it too late. And I flattened and dug in with my hands. You know, I dig in, shaking with fear. But it was still quiet. This went on for some time. And I could hear them back in the trench talking about Chelsea. What sort of team you reckon they'll have? I thought, this is not too good. Me stuck out here and them talking about Chelsea. So I turned to look around and I told you, are you all right? I said, yes, how are you? Talking about Chelsea. But anyway, it got dark and then we dug. And we dug fast, because when it got dark, the machine guns would have a duel and we were in the middle. So we really dug and we flattened. We got down about 18 inches. We flattened just before the machine gun started up. And they come from both sides. There was their machine guns, our machine guns, and we're underneath both of them. God, blimey, didn't they belt? But anyway, it had to ease up, which it did, and we dug a bit faster. But it's odd moments, dotty, yes. But trenches were deepened. The weather was bad. It was really bad, because you sat in the trench, and the rain just poured on you, had this bit of kind of a plastic sheet in, and you sat there and let a puddle form and gently eased it off and wait for another puddle to form. It was cold, it was dead. But that wasn't the point. The point was you still alive. Then dug little holes in the wall of the trench, and we had little iron canisters with thermite and dynamite and a wick. In theory, you lit these wicks, and as the wick burnt down, then you threw it. Perhaps if you were lucky, you blew a tank up. But to me, on the left of me, started the Spaniards. I think they were the listers. They'd come up in the trench, and they weren't bad. Young boys, very young, looking as they just left school, larking about. And they were quite good, because one of them gave me a bit of bread. Have a bit of this, he said. So then we heard the Moors. We thought it's going to be attacked. Stand to, so I said, oh, stand to, for sister. Oh, they immediately become very serious. But the attack didn't develop. So this went on, and I was given a job as the guard. Wasn't bad, you were relatively safe. Mostly spent bullets, and the shells were rare. I had this guard for about 4 months. All sorts of little incidents occurred there.
Where was this?
Harama. And not bad, I must say that. because when the sun got warmer, you started to warm up all the... You start to swell with former rheumatism, your knees. But when the sun warmed up, you got felt so much better. And after a time, the ammunition dump appeared, which was company. They put some dugouts in the side of the hill, and it wasn't too bad. Got better even then. So this went on, and the weeks went on. And we're getting 3 days leave in Madrid, four at a time. They couldn't give you leave, but they took four at a time, and I went to Madrid. At these 3 days, Supersetters, the boys gave you their money if they weren't going. And I thought that was pretty good. It was Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times. I saw that first time. Found this hotel, which was very cheap. Food wasn't bad. You had some soup, rice bread, grapes and sugar melon. Then you had a bed at night. First time I'd slept in a bed for ages. And to sleep in that bed, and everything went quiet. You could hear the machine guns and rifles all round the edge of the city. You could make them out distinctly. It was so quiet. And sort of a lullaby, and I said to myself, here am I, sleeping in an hotel. I'm living the life of Riley. Never had it so good. And I had 3 days there and went back, and just how we got our leave. 3 days at a time, four at a time. So this went on and on and on. And there was one point that is well worth mentioning. When I was out of work in the 30s, I signed on Edgware Road Labour Exchange. The unemployment pay was 17 shillings for 26 weeks. Then 26 weeks it stopped. You went on transitional benefit. At one time it was 15 and 40 to keep a man. 2 shillings a week to keep a child, 9 shillings to keep a woman. But I was fortunate, 17 shillings. You had to feed, clothe and lodgings out of that. Obviously, it was very difficult. There were times I had to go in a cafe, order a meal, run out without paying, if I could, which I did more than once. But it is strange, it's ironic, really, that here was I, at Arama, doing this guard, in a country that...